Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen, and I'm here with our Chief Investment Officer, Robert Sears, as well as the occasional special guest from the wider investment team to answer the big questions family investors are facing today. For those who don't know us already, CapGen is a private investment office for families with capital. We are go-anywhere investors. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover any question across any asset class in any region of the world, from bricks and mortar to portfolio derivatives. In summary, this is a podcast where we answer the questions playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. Do subscribe if that sounds up your street, and you'll enjoy two episodes a month of Talking Capital. Hello, we record this in the aftermath of the weekend's attack by Iran on Israel. We seem to be pretty well telegraphed. That certainly was the sense of the market, and it was almost as though all the participants in it wanted it to be the end rather than the beginning of something bigger. So it's quite clear that Iran disclosed quite clearly what it intended to do. So it was relatively straightforward for the opponents of that action to shoot down the drones and the missiles. And so there were no, you know, dramatic casualties on the ground. And certainly the West, I think, and also Iran seems to want this thing to pass. So it was news, and we did see oil jump a bit. We saw gold go up, and certainly those with a nervous disposition would have found it all very unusual and traumatic. You know, what's been a long-standing proxy war has become a direct state-on-state one, albeit, as I say, where all the actors seem, at least for the moment, to want to pause it there. Meanwhile, the other news, and perhaps more pertinent to what we do, were the inflation prints in the US, where for the third consecutive month we had inflation perhaps, well higher, and providing evidence that that last mile, that 3-2, that 3% to 2% inflation is going to be pretty hard going, and there are forces that are pressing against it. So, Robert, I wonder if you could talk about how that fitted into what we think is going on at the moment, and the extent to which we were surprised, not surprised, by the fact that, you know, inflation didn't dramatically come down and head back towards that 2% that everyone professes to aspire to.
Yeah, I think the first thing on the outset, I would say, inflation is notoriously probably one of the hardest economic variables to predict. And short-term economic variables are hard anyway. So month-on-month changes, I think it's really a fool's game to be trying to work out which direction they're going. So I think we've got to put that into the broader context. But I think the month's data in itself is not super relevant. What it does show is a clear pattern. And I think the clear pattern is there is the hope had been from most investors that inflation was magically going back to the 2% and we're back to the old world that we'd had for the last 20 years or so. And sort of everything's on track, and we can have this economic boom, Goldilocks period for a long period of time. I think the reality is inflation once unleashed is, again, notoriously hard to remove completely. So it's not entirely surprising that the last piece of getting rid of inflation was going to be harder. And I think when we unpicked it before, I think we talked about, we have the probability we're in a higher inflationary regime. And I think that's an important statement to make, because we're talking about long, decade-long periods. And a lot of those long-term factors are pointing in an inflationary direction. And what COVID activated really was the catalyst in terms of fiscal policy and sort of market attitude towards inflation that helped unleash some of those inflationary forces. So again, our view has been medium term, we should expect an environment of higher inflation. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to have suddenly breakout inflation. That's a risk, but just higher inflation, the pressure is more to the upside, whereas the last 20 years, 30, even 40 years have been a period of disinflation and inflation being removed. So I think that medium-term outlook, again, should frame and is really important for investors. And that's based on the fact that we had a lot of those forces moving in a different direction. So whereas we had 40 years of falling interest rates on the back of globalization and Chinese working population, sort of increasing the number of workers coming onto the world as two examples, we now are in a period actually the other way around where we're seeing deglobalization, the onshoring of investments. We're seeing heightened geopolitical risk in terms of climate change and actions in terms of the energy transition. Again, they're highly inflationary. So again, these forces that push towards inflation in a number of different directions, both in terms of economic directions, in terms of interest rates, but also the geopolitical risk being higher and climate change in terms of sustainability, we're all pointing towards higher inflation. So I think the risk is certainly for higher inflation. Now, there are two big forces against that, namely in the medium term, AI, and also the potential impact of China trying to force some of its excess supply. There is quite a deflationary force in China, given there's lots of manufacturing capacity that they're trying to export to the rest of the world. Those forces are somewhat deflationary. So there is still this balance. We're not certain which direction it would go, but the medium-term outlook is certainly for higher inflation. Now, when you frame a period of inflation like that, the regime, there are clearly cycles, ups and downs. We saw that in the 1970s very clearly. Inflation comes in waves, and this is the natural response. Really, it can be linked to the business cycle, but it's also linked to the response of participants in a complex dynamic system. And if we think about COVID, that's exactly what happened. We had everybody's complacent about inflation. Then we had the supply side issues. We thought they were temporary, but then it looked like they were people suddenly thought inflation was lasting for longer. But sure enough, a lot of them were temporary. It just took a bit longer for those supply side issues to work their way through. But now they've worked their way through, and arguably we're having some of the supply chain is a bit tighter again. And so there's a slight tick up in manufacturing. So whereas manufacturing had slowed the last couple of years, we're now seeing quite clearly, again, from the start of the year, manufacturing is bottoming, maybe bouncing a little bit. We're seeing that in the PMI data. Certainly the manufacturing cycle is improving a bit. So the environment overall does look late cycle. So I think those two things, where are we in the cycle? It looks like a late cycle economy with the economy pretty close to potential. And in a regime where the longer term forces are quite inflationary, it's perhaps natural you have this sort of inflationary environment where inflation surprises a bit to the upside. And we see it most notably in commodities. That's an asset which really responds to current conditions. And we've seen this bounce in commodity prices of late, partly due to supply side issues in a number of commodities, but also due to where we are in terms of the economic cycle. So I think that where we are in the cycle, where the longer term forces are, investors should be thinking about higher inflation as a bigger risk than previously.
Yes, if I was to link the two things together, Robert, as you did, so Iran-Israel and inflation, the Iran-Israel confrontation is a reminder that there's just more geopolitical risk in the world. There are more possible disruptions to trade. There are more arguments in favor of reshoring, onshoring, moving your supply chain physically closer to your home market, and those are all factors that will, as you say, further add to the inflationary pressures in the global economy. So there is some linkage between the fact that we are reading about more geopolitical news at the moment and the fact that that inflation goes up. And as you say, you know, our view is that's a multi-year. These things go in very, very long cycles, and so this isn't going to go away soon. But just in the very short term, Robert, can you talk about, well, okay, so what's the Fed going to do? And as we've chatted about previously on these, the where we thought we were going to be at the beginning of the year, where we, the market, where consensus, recognizing always that consensus hides a very wide range of opinions, but the midpoint at the beginning of the year was for quite a number of cuts in 2024. and the news from that point has all been slightly pushing in a different direction, which is, well, no, actually, there won't really be quite as many cuts as we were anticipating. So just moving from that sort of multi-year inflationary environment to, okay, here and now, and what's the Fed going to do? What's your sense of what we can expect for the remainder of the year from the Fed?
When I'm talking about short-term predictions, I think it's, again, I wouldn't sort of say, what's the Fed going to do in July, up or down? It's an interesting game, but it doesn't really give you a high chance of succeeding. And it's not really helpful in terms of investing. But where the short term and sort of where you're saying between now and the end of the year, I think it's important to think in terms of tendencies. So you think for policymakers, is there a tendency in this environment, if it's a close decision, are they going to be hiking or lowering in this type of environment? Because they do base it on the economic data that comes in between now and then. And I think the tendency at the moment is to keep rates where they are and still be fighting inflation. And that's a lot of it is due to the fears that have been knocked into these central bankers, the conditioning they've had for the last 40 years. So the tendency is inflation's the enemy. So we're going to not let inflation get out of control. So they're unlikely to cut in an environment where the inflation data, as we say at the margins, is likely to surprise to the upside. So I think if we're saying, well, is the tendency at the moment between now and the end of the year for the Fed to cut less than people expect, I think that's certainly the case. Now, having said that, I think when the pressure comes, if we're looking over time, the environment we're in at the moment is an environment where the Fed are likely to be behind the curve. So arguably, the Fed could have hiked even more, and maybe they've stopped a bit too early. And I think we're going to see that, where inflation persistently is a bit higher than policy rate. So it's an environment where the Fed's behind the curve. Again, that's very different to the last 35 years or so. Since really 2009, monetary policy has been consistently behind the curve. Fiscal policy is now caught up. So I think that's the long-term tendency to think. And that's when we get into a crisis, markets start to drop, and just persistently, interest rates are likely to be lower than where they should be. But where we are short-term, the tendency at the moment is we don't want to look bad. We don't want to let inflation get out of control. And you can think a bit in terms of the two market analogies, I think, to think about where the market's been is, it's the Mr. Market analogy from Benjamin Graham, which works for equities. It works for economic data too. And we've had that with interest rates. At the start of the year, everyone thought the Fed is cutting. So that becomes, we swing the pendulum too far. The reality is they were never going to cut as many. And we talked about 7 cuts at the start of the year was completely unthinkable. And the pendulum's swinging back the other way. And we're getting banks now, Goldman Sachs, talk about no cuts for the year. Again, maybe it's going to go too far, but that's we're just getting the perception to go the other way. The reality stayed probably somewhere in the middle. You're sort of overshooting. Now, the only other analogy I was going to use, which is important, is there is reflexivity here. The Soros thought is actually what the market prices in changes conditions itself. Because so many cuts happened, that juices up financial conditions, makes them very easy, juices up equity prices, and that makes it less likely the Fed is able to cut. So again, to that tendency, that increases the chance. The more buoyant markets are, the less likely the Fed's going to cut. But it works the other way around. If now interest rates are going up enough, the market starts to sell off, that can force the Fed to act between now and the end of the year. So what could change that course? We're talking about the Fed at the moment is likely to keep rates where they are, is a big market and quick market sell-off, which tightens conditions, could make them change their play. So there is definitely, and we talked about this reflexive dance, this is what's happening between the Fed and the market, forcing it one way or the other. And as the market's swinging from one direction to the other, we just happen at the moment to be in the tightening conditions, and we're seeing a somewhat of pressure on equities, but there's still a lot of good news priced into those equity markets at the moment.
You mentioned, Robert, that whilst there were inflationary forces in the global economy, there are also disinflationary ones, and amongst those is artificial intelligence. And it is moving very quickly. I would commend those who haven't looked at it to go and look at the YouTube video of Tesla's sales assistant AI talking to a customer. It's really very impressive. And here at CapGen, we're trialing Microsoft's Copilot, which is a generative AI tool that sits on top of Microsoft Office. So there are lots and lots of things happening. And the more we adopt AI, the more you have a disinflationary force to counter some of the inflationary ones. But the perhaps the paradox or irony in all of this is that what we know about our future, whether that's an AI future or a sustainable energy future, it's going to require a lot of kit and a lot of electricity. So you know, AI is a huge consumer of electricity, which has to be produced somewhere. And if we're going to do that in a sustainable fashion, we'll need more commodities. Oh, and meanwhile, the geographies in which commodities are being produced are geopolitically more febrile. And we have seen how commodities have both benefited, I suppose, and contributed to the inflation surprise. And we know that in the long run, we're going to need a lot more commodities to get towards the future that we all aspire to. But again, bringing that back to the present, Robert, I wonder if you could talk about, again, how we have seen what's happened, the extent to which what's happened in commodity markets has been a surprise to us, and what it is we think lies ahead of us in coming months.
Yeah, I think to your point, it is all a matter of timescale. In the long run, I think that's when we always talk about commodities prices and the threat that there aren't enough resources in the world. The reality is human ingenuity usually wins out. It's just quite a long time it needs to get there. And that's be the same with AI. The productivity gains are going to come. Talking about energy, we're going to have energy abundance probably in the next 50 years. So energy will almost be a free resource at that point as a result of technology that we use. But for investing, that long term, you've got to balance against the short term. And that's where we look at commodities. And commodities where that really the rubber hits the road. Energy may be free in 50 years' time, effectively, but at the moment, it very much isn't. And when we have a world where we're looking at the cycle, short term, late cycle environment, commodity prices go up. And commodities really have shown us this, as we talked about the COVID distortion, it really highlighted where on the good side, we have had a recession in the last 3 years. Commodity prices were off more than 20% from when Russia invaded. Everyone was afraid of commodity prices, but actually they dropped. And, you know, we had effectively a technical bear market in commodities over that period of time. Now we see since the start of the year and really late last year that the manufacturing cycle is turning. That is where we're starting to see this late cycle environment really hit into commodity prices. So I think, is it surprising commodity prices are going up in a world, late cycle world? No, you'd sort of think it could do. That's number one. I think number two, we'd look at the supply demand. In terms of the supply demand for commodities, we've had this period where commodities have been underinvested as an asset class, underowned, but also in terms of production, there's been a lack of investment across the commodity complex. So when there is this tightness of demand, it does take a while for a lot of commodities, particularly those which are extractive, to actually see supply respond. And that again forces pressure up in the short term. And we're starting to see that effect now. So again, that's not entirely surprising in that type of environment. And I think the last more technical point, so that's sort of, we talked about the cycle of where we are. We talked about the sort of supply demand of various commodities. But when we look at commodities as an investor, I think there are three big sources of return. There's the T-bill return. This is if you're investing in commodity futures. So because you're investing in futures, you get the return is your cash. The collateral is invested in short-term T-bonds. Now, interest rates are up, so that's good news. Tick number one. I think tick number two really is spot price of commodities. Are they going up or down? Well, we've talked about supply demand. But the third part, which is linked to that supply demand, is the shape of the curve. Because as a commodity future investor, you're buying one futures contract, holding it for a while, and then you have to sell it as time expires and buy a new one as the curve elapses. So for example, you're buying a commodity in 3 months' time. When it becomes a one-month contract, you roll again and you buy the 3 month. So the shape of the curve, like with interest rates when you're buying with a bond, actually does impact your return. Now, a lot of commodities are now in backwardation. So that actually provides another source. The roll yield provides another source of return. And that's been a good time for a long-term investor to invest in commodities when you have those three things all in line. And actually, in our asset allocation work, that's one of the signals which is quite important. So we've had signals pointing both from the cycle, but also valuation of commodities that's pointing to them looking relatively appealing. So at the margins, we're looking for ways to add that to portfolios. Now, we have that through gold directly, which has been one of the key winners of commodities at the moment, because it is also linked to geopolitical risk. And we talked about on last episode, linked to the sort of threats and fears about currency debasement in the US based on the US budget, as an example, budget deficit. So we're seeing gold one way to play it. Commodity futures managers are another way actively to play commodities, which we have within our portfolio, and they provide a good portfolio hedge, as well as positions in gold miners. So again, taking advantage of equities linked to commodities. And I think lastly, whether we add some commodity exposure, which we have over the long term, can be a good hedge against an inflationary environment. The only environment they do badly in, unfortunately, is the recession. So when you see you tip over, commodities do best just at that late cycle. But as they're one of the instruments, the asset classes, which really respond to current economic conditions. So they do tend to do badly in a recession. So I think for a long term, if we're talking about that medium term outlook for inflation, actually investing in commodities in the various forms can be a useful addition, a useful diversifier for most portfolios at this time.
Can we just talk about the commodities versus bonds question, Robert? So, you know, at the core of a portfolio is your equity allocation, because that in the long run is what's going to drive returns. And then there are other assets that you own on the margins, that which you aspire to make money, but which are also there in order to diversify and cushion the risk that comes with owning equities. And so in that sort of diversifying basket, you could put commodities, you could put bonds. What's your feeling at the moment about what is the right balance to have between those two options?
Yeah, so I think broadly we do think about, I think if you're thinking on the top level for portfolios, you think you've got your return generating assets and you've got your diversifiers. And the balance between those two, the bigger the chance of bad event, i.e. recession or market selling off, the more diversifiers you have and the less of those return generators. So that's one balance. And then within the diversifiers, there's the decision, well, we have three core buckets. There's protecting against those two twin enemies of most portfolios, sort of inflation risk and inflationary recession, or deflation, disinflationary recession. And to your point, Ian, exactly, you need some assets in each of those buckets. For example, a 2008-style deflationary recession, you want bonds. They're your diversifier, the asset that goes up while everything else is going down. But actually, in the 1970s, in an inflationary world, you want more commodities. They could be a better protection. And certainly in this environment, we've seen the last few years, it's been less, which is an example that we're in this inflationary regime. The diversifier to your portfolio is more likely to be that in that inflationary bucket. So our balance at the moment is a little bit more, have more of those hedges in the inflation bucket versus the deflation. Now, the third core bucket I talked about is if we're thinking one axis is about inflation, the other axis is about growth, good growth, bad growth. Well, clearly bad growth, that environment can be either inflation or deflationary, but the best hedge against growth doing badly is actually direct hedges on equities. So equities sell off in that environment. So I think at the moment, we've got more hedges in inflation than deflation, but also we've got hedges against that recession risk. So direct hedges on equities. And the last point, I think just to say, there are some assets which aren't linked to the economic cycle. We've been talking about those two variables, looking at inflation and looking at growth. The assets which can protect you but a sort of should be agnostic to the economic cycle, primarily sit within the alternative assets. So that's why we have more hedge funds at the moment in those spaces, like some market neutral exposure linked to value equities or those futures trading managers we've talked about. They can really hedge, and yet you're not taking a position on the economic cycle because it can be sort of quite challenging to know where you are. And lastly, I'd say, gold somewhat. Some assets don't sit neatly in one of those buckets. Gold can sit in both buckets. So that's why gold actually looks appealing at the moment. It will do better than bonds in an inflationary bust, but also it can do well in a deflationary bust because it's linked to real yields. And also if the threat is coming from, say, geopolitical risk, gold can rally quite well. So again, at those margins, if we're thinking of tactically what instrument we're using, we're preferring gold over bonds as a decision, again, within that diversifying bucket.
Sticking with real assets and sticking with news items, I think we all saw the recent news that Blackstone is going to be taking private a residential REIT in the US for $10 billion. It's quite striking that Blackstone's become a buyer. I mean, I would note that although $10 billion is a huge sum of money in the context of the capital deployment that Blackstone makes, it isn't necessarily so large. But I wonder, Robert, how you saw that. How did you fit that into what you think's going on in the US real estate market, I suppose, generally, but also particularly in the case of residential? It was a striking news item.
It really was. And I think this is one of the key sources of information in our business, really, is not only are you looking at economic data and trying to get a view, looking at how other people are positioning, but I think it's talking to our network and other senior investors, serious allocators, CIOs, and asking them that question. And the one question I ask at the moment, more than any other, is, what's your take on US real estate? Are we near the bottom? Because it's quite a hard one to judge. This is truly that try to catch that falling knife. A lot of office property in particular, if we're taking that really damaged sector in the US, there's a big divergence of opinion that is this a secular trend or not? A lot of people, this looks like a screaming bargain. You're picking up these properties really cheaply at this point in time, and there will come a point where it looks attractive. But again, a falling knife is hard to catch, and a lot of people are feeling it's a bit too soon. So I think there is a divergence of opinion there. It's not clearly, I think most people are on the cautious side of sort of thinking this is going to take some time to play out, which seems a fair assessment if you think that actually with property, you're waiting a lot of times for the catalyst of pain to increase the interest rates, which is when there's a refinancing. So it just takes time as refinancings happen for some of the assets to get dislodged and for there to be activity, particularly on the private side. So I think more people would consider now's a moment to wait, and that's certainly been the case. Clearly, Blackstone are moving somewhat in that direction. And I think, it's an asset class where it's highly unique as well. So certainly there are assets which can be bought at very appealing prices, but you need to be very discriminating. I don't think it's a market where you can easily make big sort of binary bets. Mainly as well, because it is so interest rate sensitive. And actually, as we were talking about in the first question, the pressure on rates, if anything, is to go up. So there could be some more pain to come, which I think adds to that factor. So I think practically, what are we doing about that? How are we approaching it? I think, firstly, we've made some allocations to distressed investments we talked about last year, which can go into real estate. And a lot of those haven't been deployed yet. So that can be deployed nicely over this period rather than making a exact timing moment. I think also we're actively researching adding back some real estate exposure, which at the moment we have no liquid REITs, which we usually have on a structural basis. We sold those quite a few years ago now, I think it was 2020, which has helped us sidestep this environment. But when we're looking at real estate, yes, there's the argument about interest rates making that call, are things just so cheap they're going to bounce? But equally, it's still a market where there are these big long-term trends which are very much affecting different sectors. So having that choice of sectors is very important, and you can make a lot of money as well as the choice of asset, but just by choice between sectors. So in the REIT space, at the moment, we haven't made the call, but we're considering whether to go long short. And also, we're more likely than not to use an active manager at that moment. So again, that's an active area of research, but it's go active because you need to be discriminating on asset and sector. And it may even be an environment where you want to go long short. Again, that depends partly on the view on interest rates. And lastly, in the private space, again, where's there pressure, there will be opportunities. So we are looking at opportunistic managers. So that depends on the quality of the manager as well as the opportunity set, and are they in the right structural theme. So we allocated earlier this year to a very high quality manager in Iberian real estate, which are targeting some of those long-term structural themes such as logistics and data storage. So themes that can do well, but with their skill set being the driver of returns. And we're also doing a search to see, is there a similar manager in other parts where they're distressed, for example, Germany. So I think we're not pulling the trigger in a big way. We've already started allocating to some of the distress, but we'll look to build that over the course of the time. So I think in that timing question, I think there's still time to add, and maybe now's a bit early. We're still a bit on the downswing, particularly as there's some pressure on the rising rates at the moment.
Yes, and I think to link to conversations we had with Ross, who runs our real estate practice, it's very much about picking individual assets or individual managers of very, very high quality, and to stay with the assets. There are opportunities to buy very, very attractive assets at the moment, because as we know, in all circumstances, there's a mean expectation, but there's a wide range, whether that's market consensus or what happens to market pricing on average. Times are tough for real estate, but that hides the fact that there are some cheap assets out there. But you have to do a lot of work to be able to underwrite them, and it is all about the individual asset. And there are moments and pockets of cheapness, which is very much what Ross is seeing at the moment in London. There are, for example, some very good assets to be bought. Anyway, thank you, Robert. Thank you very much for joining us, and look forward to you joining us again soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You can subscribe to Talking Capital on all major platforms. Capital Generation Partners, LLP, is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority and is registered as an investment advisor by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. This podcast and opinions expressed do not constitute investment advice and do not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase any security or any other investment or product. Nothing said during this podcast should be construed as an invitation or inducement to engage in investment activity. All information and opinions expressed herein are current as of publication and are subject to change without notice. The information contained in this podcast does not constitute research or recommendation from Capital Generation Partners to the listener. Capital Generation Partners makes no representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or of any of the information contained in this podcast. And any liability, therefore, including in respect to direct or indirect loss, is expressly disclaimed. Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. This podcast may not be copied, reproduced, further distributed to any other person, or published in whole or in part for any purpose. Further information, including our privacy statement, can be found on our website at www.capitalgenerationpartners.com.